You are listening to the Riverfront Church Podcast, a place to explore faith, history, ideas, and more.
Hello and welcome today. I am Pastor Edwin at the Riverfront 505 Podcast, and I'm excited for several reasons. One is, I have to plug this in, our outdoor worship is starting back up June 2nd. We will be at Hare Pavilion at the Riverfront in Wilmington. And we will also be live streaming that service on Facebook. So check us out at the Riverfront Church Facebook page. But I'm also really excited because we have Noel Toscano with us as a guest in our studio. And among many things, she is a beloved daughter of the living God. And she is currently working with a church that is having several conversations about how to be the church and how to connect the story that had originally brought them into the faith and connect that to the larger community and how they can serve and respond in relation to that. And she is also a resident in the state of Delaware. Is it Wilmington?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, great. Well, welcome, Noel. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your faith journey. You mentioned earlier you were Southern Baptist. Did you grow up Southern Baptist?
I did. Thank you for having me. I grew up as a pastor's kid, actually.
PK. PKs out there? No. Hello? Hello? Okay, no one's saying anything.
It's going to be okay. You'll be okay someday. I promise. Yes, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, actually, and my dad was a Baptist pastor, and I watched my parents minister together, and they had many like dips and dives in ministry, and I watched them, the stress of it, and I watched their ministries grow, and I loved it, you know. But there was a part of me as a pastor's kid that always felt like I had to look the part, and kind of be perfect.
A lot of pressure.
It was. It felt like, it felt like my parents would say, when we're at church, you need to behave a certain way so that it reflects well on our family, so that they trust us. And then, when I would go home, it was like we're just a regular dysfunctional family. So it was hard for me to reconcile that. At times now, looking back, I feel like it was maybe hypocritical. And I wonder if that had a piece of propelling me on a journey towards making sure that what I believed was real and it wasn't my parents' faith all the time. And I went to Bible college. The boys were cute. That's really why
I went. Is that really why you went?
That's it. We visited several colleges, my parents and I, and that was the one where I just felt was a little bit, I don't know, I felt more connected to the campus. And so I went to Davis College in Binghamton, New York, from 1998 through 2002. Okay. And I've always been a person who when I was in my public school, the teachers would sort of pinpoint me and kind of ask me to lead on the team, you know, lead your class, do this, they would kind of...
Leadership positions.
Yeah, I'm leaving the room, Noelle's in charge kind of thing. Mm. But it was at my church where it was sort of like, you're supposed to submit, it's in the Bible, make sure that you're letting the men in your life lead you. And I watched my mom, who had a lot of leadership skills, really kind of defer to my dad when she had a ton of wisdom to offer. And it just didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
But I thought if it's in the Bible, it must be the way it's supposed to go. So,
and who told you it was in the Bible?
I was taught that, Ephesians 5 chapter is always put out there. Wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives. I remember, actually, when I was a newlywed, going through the Emerson Egerich's, series, Love and Respect. And it was the idea there, the concept was that men have this extra special need. It's like intrinsically, genetically, spiritually within them that they have to be respected. But women really don't have that in them. They actually have a need to be loved. And so they describe it as having the pink glasses on and the blue glasses on. And there was like a line drawn in the sand between men and women and how they will relate well together in marriage. And I mean, that was very confusing for me. While I was in college, I graduated in 2002 with a Bachelor's of Religious Education with a concentration in church ministries and theology, and that qualified me to be a very overqualified volunteer, because as a woman, there was really going to be no opportunity for me to use my degree that I worked really hard for and I paid for it, you know, and I loved learning and I loved being given the tools to study the Bible. And in my church, there was really no room for that. It was kind of like, don't you worry. We have tons of opportunities for you to go ahead and work in the nursery, you know? And I'm like, well, I really like to study. What do I do with that? You know, yeah. I really like having the commentaries out and the different cross-referencing scriptures. Like that's always been my heart. Mm. And I've always been a very curious person to try to figure it out on my own. And I didn't really see how it was going to play out for me. I know that I married a very happy-go-lucky, smiley guy who is just, he'll just tell you, he just doesn't think deeply about anything. It's why we have such a great marriage. I just talk and talk and talk, and he's just like, that's great, you know. And
did you meet him at this Bible college?
I did.
Ah, one of the cute boys.
He's okay. One of the cute boys, and he is. And then I worked for A Door of Hope, the pregnancy center, for 3 years, and very quickly went from being one of their speakers that would go into schools and talk to the kids about sexual abstinence to managing their Wilmington site. So Wilmington's always, you know, been on my heart. And so I worked there for a couple of years until I started having kids. And I have 4 sons. So
wow.
I have an 11-year-old boy, a 9-year-old boy, and a 6-year-old boy, and a 4-year-old boy. 2 of them are on the autism spectrum. So my life has happened. But in raising sons, I just started to look at my life differently. And the Southern Baptist Church that I was going to, I felt like they were very kind to me and they were loving to me. But I didn't think that the men were listening to the women. If I'm being really honest, I didn't think that they thought that it was important. I didn't see them caring about what their wives were really going through. Mm. And I felt like, I'll just be really honest, I felt like all the male elders and all the male deacons and all the male pastors were kind of in a, you know, this land of management, and the women were on an island by themselves, and they were not represented, and they were not.
And they were in an island of servants, basically. Or what were they? What was that? What did they do on that island, so to speak?
Ken and I were talking about that. They were making home. That's what it was. They were. I led Bible studies that. You know, sometimes there would be 2 or 3 women there, and sometimes we had times that there was like 50 women in like one person's living room. We were, you know, wow. trying to all cram in. These women wanted theology. They wanted to talk about it. But there were so many courses that were on like how to be a good wife. And so there was no place for singles to thrive. Yeah. You were not in the loop. Everybody looked, talked, and walked the same, and the women were really trying to fit into a certain mold, and that was to make sure that you had babies, and so if you had a fertility issue, you felt horrible about yourself, and everybody would always ask, once you did have your babies, you better lose that weight fast, or somebody was going to comment and offer you, you know, I got a Y membership, why don't you come alongside me? And it was like there was all these things that were so important to make sure that you did in order to be this good, godly wife, and one of them was to be gentle and quiet spirited, which I knew I was in trouble, you know, the minute that started. And so I started to become more vocal about it on Facebook. And I cannot tell you the war that was happening between.
And when did that start?
That started 4 years ago.
4 years ago.
Yeah. And at 4 years ago, I started to question a lot of the way that I felt like, I mean, essentially the biggest issue for me was that women are temples are of the Holy Spirit, and there is a cap on it. In the name of being humble and submissive, and those gifts are not being released, and men certainly aren't gleaning from it. And that was a problem for me, especially because I was raising sons, and because I felt like in my current church, there were other women with gifts that they weren't using. So as I started to kind of ask those questions and do deeper study on the clobber verses, the verses that we'll go through and kind of cherry pick and go, let's remove context, let's remove the fact that, you know, Paul's writing a letter and we don't know what happened here, and instead we're just going to go ahead and say, here you go, we're going to put this in our doctrinal statement, it's true for all people for all of time. And I started to question that, and I'll tell you what, people were angry, they were, I mean.
And this was just your personal Facebook page?
That's
you
it.
You were just putting questions up?
Yes.
And
so
people were wondering, why aren't you this gentle, quiet person?
They told me that what I was saying was dangerous.
Wow.
Yeah, I was dangerous, and so my church actually had the women's ministry team, leadership team, came to my house and sat down on my couch and told me I had to stop because I was being viewed as a leader in the church because I was leading two women's Bible studies.
And this was 4 years ago.
This was
2015.
Yeah, this was 4 years ago. So, you know, and for me, I thought, what if I am on the wrong track here? But once you're on it, you just got to keep exploring, keep figuring it out. And
Martin Luther says, sin boldly.
No. You know what? I had so many like spidey senses that this in the back of my head that this wasn't right, but I couldn't figure out why and couldn't find a source. So I started reading, and I read Jesus Feminist by Sarah Bessie, and I read a bunch of books. I read a book by Jen Wilkins, which is on women in the Word, and it was from a complementarian viewpoint of submitting and letting men lead as a part of, you know, following the structure. The term she kept using was there's a structure that God has put in place and you have to honor God by following it. And I just kept reading. I read a book a week. And I was really depressed as well because my husband is a complementarian. And he loves me. He's totally fine now. But we went through a rocky road in our marriage trying to figure this one out. At one point, he felt like he was losing me because I didn't need him. Our relationship stopped being so codependent, you know, spiritually codependent, because he knew that I was figuring this stuff out on my own. It was a time of battle, an inward battle, church battle, and I feel like almost like you have to walk through it in order to get through the other side, and on the other side is peace. It's knowing what you believe. It's changing the bad foundation that had been laid for me and swapping it out and rebuilding it with the truth. So it was 2 years ago, I caught the attention, because I was blogging and writing about it a lot, of the staff at Azer Rising, and they asked me to do a couple of guest posts for them that that went a little nuts. I was talking about gender roles, and the time 2 years ago was when the trolls were really out, and they were really like, I'm just going to stay up till 4 a.m. and just like online debate people about stuff until it starts to degenerate into personal attacks. And it went there, and I handled myself pretty well against that. Like, I just tried to stick to, you know, this is the scriptural basis, and this is what the Greek word actually means, and just try to back up my argument and have a little integrity, even though I was getting a little mad. And from then on, they asked me to start writing for them. So there's a team of 5 of us who write, and we do graphics. And what we try to do is offer tools. We try to remember where we were when we were figuring it out. We try to make sure that we're not there for clickbait. We try to make sure that we're not downing men, especially the men who have been supportive in so many ways. They're the ones who gave us the voice in the first place. Mm. You know, just, I mean, like you guys are right now. Like, this is the kind of thing where women support women, and it is like that island by itself until men say, no, I want to work with you. And that validates women, because women have a huge imposter syndrome, especially when it comes to ministry. I think that men do too. But I think that women really, really do, because of an upbringing that really taught them that they're supposed to be calm, docile. That's what's attractive. Mm. You know, he's going to need you to need him for things. That's going to be important for him. So it's a very different world now. The pendulum has definitely swung, and Azer Rising is mindful of that, that we do not want to be a place that is a land and a community where people come and they're there to bash men. That is not what we're about. We're trying to create a space that offers community and discussion, and everything we write is public. And then you can comment, and we always comment. We always, always will write back. Sometimes it takes a lot of time, which is why we need, you know, a bigger team.
You're trying to cultivate community rather than just have this forum where we just tear each other down and move on.
And in the past, we've had those times, and we've had staff writers who couldn't handle it, and that was okay. You know, and there's been times that I've been offended, and, you know, we don't want anybody to come to our place and space and comment on something that we wrote, and now it's ruining their night. So we're kind of protective and try to create dialogue that helps people to grow and doesn't make people feel awful. Because I think that the internet is getting crazy. You know, there's a lot of anger out there and a lot of rage, And we hope to be a place where you can go ahead and share this thing, and now it's a tool, and make your friends ask that question, or go, any thoughts on this, or, you know, what do you think, or even if you disagree, set us straight. There's a couple people, every single time, there's certain people who comment, I know they're going to, like, correct something that we have said, because they're the Greek scholar, and they're the one with the, you know, the PhD, and that's okay, because we want that too, we want to get it right.
Yeah.
So we talk about a lot of different things. I tend to enjoy I'm kind of a storyteller, so I like going and doing a retelling of a woman's story that happened in the Bible, and that sheds light on her in a positive note, that because it was been told through a lens of patriarchy for a really long time. For example, the Samaritan woman at the well, you know, she's been called this sinful person when divorce would not have been legal for her, and so five times this woman is rejected in a culture where polygamy is accepted. She was simply cast aside, and men and women were not supposed to speak to each other in public, and Jesus honored her in the way that he spoke to her. And then she was the first Samaritan convert. Not only was she the first Samaritan convert, she went and told everybody that she knew, and then there was a huge
Samaritan evangelist.
Yes, yeah. And they listened to her. They listened to her, which is a testament to any woman who's felt rejected, any person who's felt rejected, which all of us have. And to see ourselves in these people and go, God honored them. God honored them. This is not a story of dishonor. This is a story of honor. This is a story of courage. This is a story for you and me, because they're just people just like us. So
that is powerful that you mentioned that, because actually I had a friend who called me, and he's a guy, and he had called several preachers, including women, and he was saying, what's your take? He didn't like the usual traditional take. And even the women were like, yeah, you know, you've had five guys, and the one you're living with now ain't your husband. Like, oh, that's kind of funky behavior there. And he was like, what? First off, we're not told what happened.
Right.
So he's like, what if she's widowed? What if five times this guy, the husband, died? So she's like a pariah in the community. Or as you just raised, what if five times she's been rejected? You know, she's been traded off or rejected. And so Jesus, because that makes the Jesus, what he's sharing, make more sense. Because Jesus doesn't go like, by the way, here, I'm going to shame you.
Right.
And then Jesus is almost bringing up, I know about your shame.
Mm-hmm.
Not I'm not here to shame you. I know about what's happened to you.
Right.
And suddenly she's like, oh my gosh, you must be a prophet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's such a powerful story when we switch it. Like, here's a person that doesn't have much agency, but suddenly we've given her the agency of, like, yeah, what's she been doing, right? And and it's like, well, or Jesus is highlighting how she hasn't had that agency.
Right.
Maybe the man she's with hasn't married her because he's poor or because he doesn't want to marry her. And they're sort of in a beneficial relationship, maybe.
Right.
You know, we don't know. There's just so much richness the way you just brought that out. I have so many questions for you, but the first thing I want to do is, just for anyone who's hearing this for the first time, especially if they have felt like you, if they felt like they've had to take a back seat and they've felt the story has never really been about me, or I've never been in the story, what would you say to them right now? Because I want to get into academic questions and tell us a little bit more, but if you were to just say, what's a word from the Lord for them right now?
Well, I think that it's really important to notice that if you really look at the Bible from, you know, the totality of it versus the pulling out different verses and viewing the Bible as this instruction manual to follow to a T, the truth is that it's really it's many narratives of people who actually lived, and God always, like, his favorite thing is to use the least likely, you know, the least likely people. And that just is so inspiring, I think, because oftentimes we look around and go, who's going to fix this? You know, who's going to change this situation? Who's going to make this right? And to realize and recognize that God has given us the tools to be able to do it, to be able to do our part in our sphere of influence, to be Jesus and to show God's love to people is within our power, and that there's never a reason to back away from loving somebody. So I have a friend, a dear friend, whose husband passed away over the weekend, and I've only been friends with her for about a year, and I felt like I shouldn't go see her. You know, I should wait because there's family, I'm sure, that's around her. And I went there, so I went to see her yesterday morning, and she was just grieving, and it was so hard. And I said, I'm so sorry I didn't come see you yesterday. You know, I felt like maybe there were better friends, you know, that you should have. And she said, no, you come see me anytime. I feel like we've always been friends. Don't ever let anything hold you back from loving other people well. And even if it seems a little silly, even if you're worried, you know, oh, their fridge is probably already full, or, you know, or I don't know. It's hard. And I think for women especially, too, and the generation coming behind is better at this, but I'm 39 years old, so I'm an exogenial or whatever that is. I was born in December 1979, so I know what it's like to, you know, have handwritten love letters to my husband. And I also know what it's like to text him, you know, we need milk. So this age of technology happened on my watch when I was kind of in a prime of adulthood. And I can see how, I can see specifically how the millennials might be confused. I think you would agree with me just because of other things we've talked about already, but I was born in 1979, and my parents were brand new baby believers. They, you know, this was like this unplanned pregnancy. I'm a twin, and my mom was like, "Oh, you know, my life's different now." She was 20 years old, and the church swooped in and kind of took hold of my parents and discipled them and took them on and taught them everything. And then this is in 1980, which is they grew up in the 70s and the 60s. They grew up having friends overdose. They grew up with having people that they knew be drafted to Vietnam. The world was a very unstable place. 1982 is when HIV came out. I mean, they felt like the answer, like many of my friends' parents did, the answer is church to protect our kids. And they went ahead and they gave us a fear-based faith and said, you know,
because they were afraid.
That's it.
Yeah.
I don't fault them for it anymore. I've given them a tough time about it in the past in conversations, like, shouldn't you have known better? Now I realize I'm totally going to mess my own kids up, and I did my best.
Even if you were amazing, yeah.
Yeah,
there'll be some reason.
And I'm not.
You went to 9 baseball games instead of 10, and that's all they need.
There's always something.
Yeah.
But I think that the reason a lot of the millennials are walking from church is because they don't want that fear-based faith, and they don't know how to come back. You know, they don't want that purity culture, you know, I got to wear a ring and I'm responsible for this guy over here's thought life by what I wear. Like, it all is like, I mean, it's just baloney. Yeah. Like, and it was just laid into us that this is your identity as a woman. It's all about identity. And as we grew up, we were given a certain identity, a mold that said, this is what a godly woman looks like. And we were told, fill it.
Yeah.
Fill it. And then when we didn't, we felt like failures. And there was a grieving process through that. And the men in our lives didn't know what to do about it. They did not know how to help because it's okay that you don't get it. It's fine. There's things we don't get, you know. And I have very specifically friends who are women of color who I've tried to be an ally and come alongside and understand and ask the questions and be there for them. And they're like, Noelle, it is okay that you don't get this, you know? So everybody has their story. And I think when it comes to identity and learning who God has made you to be, the sky really is the limit. And I think that we have to be cautious in making sure that in teaching biblical principles that help our children to understand God's expectations of them, that we're not imposing our own expectations on them. So that's how legalism is born. Like, you feel convicted about something, and then you go ahead and say, I'm not going to watch that show, I'm not going to drink that drink, I'm not going to do that thing, I'm not going to hang out with those people. You felt convicted. And then you assume that it was wrong for everybody,
yeah,
and went ahead and told everybody that they shouldn't do that. You know, and then they went, you're not my people. And then all of a sudden you lose that discussion, you lose that community. And so I think that's what's happened to a lot of them. And I think that re-looking at how community really is born in friendships that fall outside of a specific church structure and fellowship, you know, organized, that's a key component. So, like, I want to see women be free, and I want to see them be free in church. I want to see them free in their marriage. I think their husbands want them to be free too. I know that God wants them to be free. What does that even begin to look like?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And that's part of your work.
Yes. Right?
So tell us a bit about what you said Azer
Rising.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is, I'm English as a second language, so anytime there's a foreign word in my ear, it's like people in this area are like, Winterthur, and I'm like, well, it really should be Winterthur, right? And the Eiffel Tower should be Tour Eiffel, you know? So, similarly, it's a Hebrew word. You could say Etzer or Etzer, but for simplicity, we're going to call it Azer, rising, which is the way you called it. So tell us, what does that word mean, and why did you guys pick that?
Azer is the word used for woman when she was created. God made a man and a woman in his image. He created them totally equal at that point. There is absolutely no hierarchy that you will find in Genesis. And so the two of them have been given dominion over the earth. You got the plants, you got the animals, use them up, you know, be a good steward of it. Go and be fruitful and multiply. Go be image bearers. Continue to be image bearers. Your kids will be image bearers. You and I are image bearers in the same way. And an Azer was in the situation. It was brought up because the way that passage goes is it was not good that man would be alone. And so God allowed Adam to go through this whole naming of the animals this time where it was almost like Adam needed to know that these weren't going to work. Yeah. Maybe so he would have an extra special appreciation.
And create a Bob Dylan song. So Bob Dylan wrote a song about naming the animals. It's actually pretty cool. Check it out sometime.
I'm sure that was God's plan. And so the term Azer is used to be, it means helper. Mm-hmm. And it means helper suitable, meaning it was a perfect fit, a perfect match. It does not mean subordinate. There's no meaning in there. The term Azer is used over 20 times in the Old Testament, and it's almost always used to mean God. Mm-hmm. When God is swooping in to save the day because Israel is under, they're getting their butts kicked in military fashion. So I believe Moses names one of his kids Eliezer, which means the Lord is my help. And the idea there is that somebody would come in and save the day because the day needed saving.
Right.
And that's what an Azer is. And that is what she did for him. And in Genesis 3:16, it says, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. And our belief is that this is not the way, the structure that God is designing. This is a prediction. Not that this should happen this way. This is what will happen.
Out of the brokenness.
It's out of the brokenness that he will sin against her by ruling over her. Mm. And we have quite seen that in history. And as much as in the U.S., we're pretty like on point if you look at, you know, all over the world in different countries and different continents, the sins and crimes against women are catastrophic. They have absolutely no rights. And so this prophecy, we call it, we have a little thing, it's a prophecy, not a policy, when it comes to you know, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. Meaning, and I think the ESV takes it grossly out of context. We make no bones that we don't love the ESV.
English Standard Version. Yeah.
They're not the only ones. The King James Version does it as well, but they take inclusive language that would be like brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, siblings, and they make it sons instead of it being human beings. It says men, you know, and it's, which is technically literal, but that's not actually what it means. So the ESV says your desire will be contrary to your husband and he will rule over you. And they sort of take that liberty, and then, you know, pastors preach out of that version, and it's just, you know, so
unhelpful.
It's a lot of nuance, you know, and we talk a lot about generalizations, and but mainly we want to give women, we want to make the Bible be this thing that women read and see how much God loves them and how God has empowered them and how God has given them things to do in this world and the Holy Spirit to do it with. And we just want to be a little piece of, like, you know, pointing that out.
Yeah. There, you know, as you were speaking, there's another prophecy, because Eve and Mary are often connected.
Yes.
And there's another prophecy that Mary sings in the Magnificat that says, and the hills will be made low and the valleys will rise, right? So Azer rising.
Yes.
And the idea that God is flattening out what we, you know, build empires over, you know, power over one another, whereas God operates with power with.
Right.
God, you know, if we take what we believe, which is God has power over everything and yet doesn't use it to overpower everything.
Right.
God uses it to empower. Mm-hmm. And that's always such a burden and a blessing, because it's sort of like, yeah, in theory, we could believe God could just zap, do this, zap, do that, zap, do this. And yet God has given us human beings the project of addressing climate change and addressing immigration, you know, violation of rights of immigrants, and addressing hunger and addressing all these things. And of course we don't do it in our own strength. We do it in Christ's name by the power of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. But that's God's empowerment of us that doesn't do for and doesn't overpower but empowers. And so I think that falls right in line, right? Mm-hmm. That this prophecy that talks about the brokenness of the world, mm-hmm. is Mary is a response to it.
Yes.
You know, in a sense.
It's interesting because when you really kind of look through Genesis and, I mean, other parts of the Bible as well, because Rahab's included, God really uses unexpected women to continue this line. Really courageous women that would end up becoming the line of Jesus Christ. You know, I mean, when you think about the genealogy and the ones that are mentioned, you know, Tamar that completely rebelled against a system and completely bucked the authority in order to make sure that she conceived and kept the line alive. Like, that was her, she saw that coming and she did something about it at risk of her own death. Like, Judah, I mean, that dude rarely does a good thing, but God still uses the messy, you know. Mm-hmm. But in many ways, the women really did redeem that line. You know, Ruth, it says she was better than 10 sons, you mm-hmm. know, because she was there and she stayed with her mother-in-law. And then she was able to give birth to Obed, who was Jesse, and then David,
yeah.
You know. And so there's Rahab, who's always viewed as this prostitute who was not even Hebrew, yeah. You know, is also included in that line somewhere, right. Along the lines. So God he's weaving together this, you know, I will put enmity between you and the woman. Mm. And that's not just Mary. I believe that all women have this thing in them that allows them to be this this light for the world. And I think that Satan hates it. Mm-hmm. Satan hates that when men and women work together cooperatively, that there's just a force to be reckoned with. Mm-hmm. Holy Spirit driving force. But there's been, you know, a system hierarchy put into place, and I'll be really honest, and from what I've seen, the system and the structure put into place that allows men to be the ones who make the rules and the decisions, a lot of times it seems like that structure is regularly fortified for his benefit, and a lot of time and energy and effort is put into his responsibility and making sure that he, you know, does that. And really what it does is it moves the island of women ministering further and further away from influence. Mm. So trying to figure that out, trying to call it out, trying to figure out how to go, this is not down with men. It's down with a system that has not allowed women to be involved. You have to break it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'll just be really honest. I don't think my dad will listen to this, but he is a pastor and he has a library and there's not a book in it by a woman. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that a lot of times, like, there's men in those roles that just honestly believe that they don't need that perspective. It's not that necessary. They haven't been taught that it would help them. So, I mean, there's something to be said where you go, okay, what does my bookshelf look like? You know, do I value the voices of many different? Is God's church diversified? And the answer is yes. You know, that God allows people to worship in many different ways. You know, as long as Jesus Christ is the absolute center of it, it's going to look different wherever you go. and allowing women to color that and be a part of it, that I believe will lead to revival. But, I mean, you better believe that Satan doesn't want that to happen. So he'll keep these structures in place. He'll keep women feeling like, I honor God best when I'm silent.
Yeah. You were seeming very exasperated when you were saying, I'm just trying to point this out, point the system, which implies there are many people that don't see it. And obviously,
yes.
You know, we can assume that. But
yes.
So for somebody listening to this that's like, you know, yes, I believe in the vision that you're talking about, but man, I don't know. I've read some feminist theory, philosophy, and I really have trouble reconciling that with Christian faith. How do you reconcile that? How do you help somebody that is at the beginning of their journey and trying to figure out, how do I make sense of this? How can you help them?
It took me a while too. There was a part of me that it's a journey with anything where you look at it, and they call it the slippery slope because they think all of a sudden you're just going to become an atheist and not believe the Bible at all because you didn't believe in somebody else's interpretation of five verses. And this is a scare tactic to keep you from exploring. But the truth is, there was a time where I thought, I'm leaning towards this way where I view it differently. I kind of see where the women aren't being utilized. So how do we go ahead and utilize women? But they still can't be pastors. In my head, I was like, it took a while. It took years to go, that's just not right. It's definitely like, you know, it's in Titus. You know, it's in Timothy. Like, you know, and relook at those verses and go, yeah, it says it's the husband of one wife. And so therefore it's men. Which, let me just look at that really quickly. I mean, that's definitely speaking against polygamy, and it's definitely saying he's faithful. And that's it. That's the crux of that particular verse. It's not saying that it has to be a man, or it would say it should be a man. It just says he needs to be faithful. This person should be faithful. So, you know, you ask yourself a question, does this person, if the person were to go into, you know, a leadership role like an elder or a pastor, what if they're single? Are they disqualified? Because then you better disqualify the Apostle Paul. Okay, because he was quite single and still managed to, you know, operate effectively, planting churches, ministering, and, you know, being a pastor in many ways to those churches.
Yeah.
So anyways, it's like trying to figure all that out and just to go, give yourself some time, read some really good books, reevaluate those verses. I'll tell you what, I spent time arguing this across the table with dear friends of mine, and we almost ruined our friendship over it. Now we're good, you know, we're fine, but it's a road. And I think that in my mind, I went through this time where I was like, well, they shouldn't, you know, women can maybe operate in this area, in this area, it's okay, but they shouldn't be ordained. And I realized that this is actually just my comfort level speaking. That's all it is. I'm just not used to it, and that's why I'm uncomfortable with it. And I think that that can be the case for a lot of people who are at the beginning of this, you know, going, I have a lot of questions, something doesn't seem right, and I need to figure it out. And the more I figure it out, the more I realize I'm going into some uncharted waters, and it is scary. People in my life are going to get mad at me, you know. There might be some rejection. There might be some conflict. And it's hard because for me, my process was openness and boldness. It was almost like I'm putting out the bait and I'm going to see who responds. And that was, in part, I was viewed as a troublemaker. But I also needed to be able to have hard discussions. I also recognized very quickly who to unfriend.
Yeah.
That helps. Who's hostile? you know, who's angry? Who's... You know, I had one guy from college very boldly say, you are a heretic and you need to repent and submit. And that's what, and I was like.
Well, Ken gets that regularly, by the way. He's a resident heretic.
That's right.
And we love him.
I think that there has to be a way that you can say, all right, this is what I see here in Scripture, and it's not adding up to the message that Jesus gave in the Sermon on the Mount when he said, you have heard it said, but I tell you. And that was always a heart condition. That was always a test your heart and make sure that you are loving others well, even your enemies. Give them everything that you have. He went ahead and washed people's feet. This isn't about anybody being in charge. It's not about women being at some table. You know, we honestly just want the honor of serving at one. You know, we just want to be included in the dialogues that are happening that can make a difference. And we want to believe that the experiences that God has given us, the insights that God has given us, do matter for the growth of the church, the Big C church. And for too long, we've been told that, you know, it's your role to really, and we value it. It's very like we and you, not us. You know, we value all the things you're willing to do in the nursery and the, you know, in the children's ministry and the hospitality ministry and, you know, and we're not going to ordain you, but can you please go pick up the grape juice for communion at the store, you know, and wipe out the cups, but you can't pass it to somebody. It's a very like, we need your help, but you're not going to be visible in this process. And the problem with that, the issue with that is that other women will look at that and they will feel insignificant in it and they will feel not as involved and they're not inspired. So for me, I was like, we had moved into the Brack X neighborhood right by BJ's and the VA hospital on Kirkwood Highway. And I thought, where can I go to church and see a woman in action? Where I Googled it. And I'm like, oh, there's like one in Philly. Not realizing that two blocks from my house is Christ United Methodist Church, pastored by Sharon O'Connor, who it was brand new to ministry. She'd only been doing it a couple years, and she and I met for lunch. And about a year later, she said, we're trying to start a new contemporary service. Will you help us? Yeah. And I had no idea that I was going to be walking in the doors of a building that was epic and had so much history and so many memories, but the congregation was aging, and they wanted to try to figure out how do we have children run through these doors again. And for the first time in my life, they cared what I had to say. And that was big, shocking huge. For yeah. me. In fact, they've told me, you got to stop talking about women, Noel. Like, we settled that 100 years ago, you know? And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. I just am still dealing with the shock of it.
Yeah.
So they invited me to preach last Sunday.
Wow.
And for the first time, I got to. And I looked out, and it was men, and they were listening, you know? And I was telling Ken, like, the worship team is a bunch of women, and the pastor's a woman, and the congregation is filled with a lot of men, and it's very interesting to just go, we're really operating on, you know, an equal playing field here. We're trying to figure out how to work cooperatively together and listen to each other and care about what each other has to say. And that, to me, I almost feel like God's like fast tracking me towards ministry before I'm like, I'm still a little, you know, reborn. Like, I feel like I've got like some birth fluid on my face still. Like, give me a towel before you give me too much to do, Lord. But I asked God for opportunity to do something that mattered. And he certainly has given me a lot to do. And I love it. I really do. I'm happier than I ever have been before, but I don't go to church with my husband anymore, because they don't have a children's ministry, and I got a slew of kids, and I'm really busy, but I'm the kind of woman whose mind needs to be working, but my house is messy. But my husband knows that if my wife is not happy, I am not happy, you know, and so he has, even though, you know, he's kind of still figuring it out, he's been really...
He's on his own journey.
Yeah, and I've had to let him.
And a shared journey at the same time.
Yes.
With you, yeah.
Yes. Parenting these guys, especially two with special needs, has been crazy. We started out really like unified in our marriage, and we're going to the store and figuring out what ranch dressing we like. If you asked me to go to the store with him and pick out like, you know, a new ketchup or something, I'd be like, what a tremendous waste of time. But that's how our lives are right now. We're kind of like, you know, we got these kids to raise, and theologically I'm doing my stuff, and he's got his stuff he's doing to make sure he's getting done what he needs to get done. But gradually we feel ourselves moving more towards each other, and truly it's because we respect each other. So he came to watch me preach. Like, he came to listen.
Oh, wow.
And that meant a lot to me because he was proud of me, and because I feel like he saw that it was something I could do. And I'm on the worship team with a bunch of other people, and singing into a microphone scares me. Oh my goodness, it scares me to death. They're always like, lean into the microphone, Noel. And I'm like, no, no, no. Like, I don't want to be heard. But they just need the support right now because we're growing. But preaching a sermon, I was ready. I was so excited. I mean, I guess that's how you know it's in you, you know, when it's not exhausting to you. It's life-giving to you. And so for me to have walked this and now 4 years later to be here, I am so burdened for the women that are still in chains somewhere. Mm. Like, how do they find freedom? You know? So the writing for A's Arising is to help them to have a tool that they can use to gently bring them on this journey, to create awareness that God has made you. And do not let the world or the church try to tell you who that person is. And he will guide you. You know, he will guide you. And if somebody is listening now who's kind of on that path, and maybe they're at the beginning steps or maybe they're in the middle somewhere, just keep going. Just keep going. The sermon that I preached this week was on Peter walking on the water. It's a series of taking a walk with Jesus. And the idea of taking that shaky walk, you know, Peter was the only one that got out of the boat. He's the only person in human history that knows what it's like to walk on water. And that with Jesus in front of his face, he still sunk like a rock. It's that little ironic because his name is Peter. But, you know, that Jesus, his faith faltered. So the idea that, you know, what hope could there be for us to have that level of faith? And I truly believe that when Jesus says to him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" He wasn't saying, "Why did you doubt me? Why did you not have faith in me?" Jesus knew that he could do it. Peter didn't. Peter did not have faith in himself to do this. And Jesus knew that he could. And so I think that so often we don't have a lot of faith in ourselves for what God is trying to do through us, that we feel like we're somehow frustrating his plan because we're not equipped enough, educated enough, refined enough, prepared enough. But, you know, if you're there, you're ready. You know, just step out of the boat and walk. It might. And I also want to point out, like, at the end, after Jesus had been resurrected, when he's on the shore and Peter's on the boat with John and the other fishermen, and there's the second great catch, Peter doesn't try to walk on water to get to Jesus. He just dives in.
Yeah, that's right.
I think sometimes we try too hard to make it look a certain way. The important thing is that we're with Jesus. Mm. You know, he's always with us. Do we recognize that? Mm. And I think that is the key for our churches, to recognize and identify that Jesus has always been with us, that he loves us unconditionally. Any of us who have kids look at our kids and go, "There's just nothing in the world that you could do that would make me love you any less. I adore you. You know, even when you're a despicable human being, I wouldn't trade you for anything." And I think that sin gets, when we think that we're allowed to judge other people's sins, I think the struggle is that it makes us have less love for people. And I think that we have to be very cautious. I think that the people are looking to church leadership and going, "Are you going to judge me for the way I look, what I say, if I am smoking a cigarette, you know, if I'm holding a drink that has a paper bag wrapped around it, if I have a tattoo that's visible?" You know, the church has a horrible reputation for being judgmental. And I think that that's been a huge problem. And I think, you know, we're ready to kind of let go of that.
Well, I've really appreciated this time. There's so much more that we can go, but we actually have a Bible study we've got to get to. But Ken had talked about doing a second episode. I see like three more. So for next time, I hope to pick up on, you guys pronounce it Kephal?
Kephal.
Oh, Kephal.
Yes.
Kephal, the Greek word for head.
Yes.
And some of the translations of that in the New Testament scriptures.
Yes.
So we're going to pick up on that next time. Okay. I'm also going to ask you, and I'm going to email this to you, but this is just to tantalize our listeners. I'm going to ask you about the Jesus Feminist book.
Great.
Mm-hmm. And just to give us a little bit of what can we take away. Mm-hmm. I'd also love to ask, you know, about your decision to leave the Southern Baptist denomination, because there are people, not just for this reason, but many reasons why they might leave.
Yes.
A church or a denomination. And so any kind of guidance you have in doing that or doing it well. Mm-hmm. And then I also think that there are going to be people across the spectrum that might look at some of the feminist or might look at some of the complementarian or might look at some of the other views. And the question is, can you be a Christian and? Mm-hmm. So can you be a Christian and a complementarian? Can you be a Christian and a feminist? Can you be, you know, et cetera? So all these questions and more as we talk about your wonderful story. Thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for your ministry. Appreciate your faithfulness in sharing this time with us. And God continue to bless you, and we'll hope to see you next time.
Thank you. you.
Thanks, everybody. Join us next time on the 505 Podcast.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Riverfront Church Podcast. You can connect with us online at riverfrontwilmo.com or on Facebook. Just search for Riverfront Church in Wilmington, Delaware. May God meet you where you are and lead you where you are meant to go.